Hi, my name is Ann Tebow Sprague, and I grew up as Ann Tebow, daughter of Muriel and Jock Tebow here in Volcano. And I was born in 1955. And my mother was very close to a lot of the elderly old-timers around this area when they moved to Volcano in 1948 and had become very good friends with some of them, one being Mr. Jimmy Scapacino and also his brother who, when I was born, after I was born and all, had passed away. But Jimmy owned the property up at the top of Boardman Hill outside of Volcano that has the Indian Grinding Rock on it, which is now Chaffee Indian Grinding Rock State Park. But at the time, it just belonged to this old Italian farmer. And I remember as a child, when we'd be, you know, go to Jackson or something, we'd come back from Jackson and we always, almost always stop at his place to say hello and make sure he was okay. And because he was elderly and he lived alone, and my mother Muriel was very dear to his heart, and he was very dear to her heart. And so we'd stop there, and they had this wonderful, at the little house, he had this wonderful, I think it was an artesian well, now that I've thought about it a little bit, but I'm not positive. But there was water that came up in an old cement cistern in front of the house. And he always had a aluminum or tin dipper hanging there next to it so you could get icy cold drinks of water. And in the summertime, it was just so good. It was really cold water and it tasted so good. It was, and on a hot summer day when we come back from Jackson, of course, cars back in the late 50s, early 60s didn't have any, well, actually, that would have been late 50s, didn't have any air conditioning or anything, so we'd be hot and sweaty, and we'd get a cold drink of water at Jimmy's place. And he'd also, in the late summer, he'd bring us corn that he'd grown, freshly picked off the stalks, and they weren't just regular corn, they were Indian corn. And we didn't get Indian corn from anybody else but him. And it was all purple and red and orange, and it was the sweetest corn in the whole wide world. It was the best corn, and he loved it. He laughed because I would eat it just raw like that. My mother said, go ahead, eat it. I'd just eat it. And so we'd always end up with one less at least by the time we got home to cook it. But, and he had a horse that was, it was an old draft horse, and he thought I was very funny because I was so horse crazy that I named this horse Black Beauty, even though he wasn't really black, and he was beautiful to me. He was a big, beautiful draft horse that I would go over and feed carrots to and apples and talk to. I never got to ride him though, but he wasn't a riding horse. And Jim was just this really nice man, and he would take us out onto the rock. And we would walk around the rock and look for fairy rings under the oak trees and sit around and look at the acorns that had fallen into the grinding holes. And we would hike all over the place up there. And my mother loved it and was so amazed at the rock. And Jimmy just treasured that beautiful big rock. And he didn't want anything bad to ever happen to it, and he knew he was, you know, his health was going and his age was playing a part on it, and he was going to die, and he didn't want anything bad to happen to the place. He thought that somebody was going to take the property and subdivide it or something. There was actually a realtor that lived back behind the property that had already talked to Jimmy about wanting to buy the property to build on. And so Jimmy went to my mom and said, Muriel, I need to save my rock, and what can I do? And my mother went off and started thinking about it, and she went to a lot of the local Miwok that she found out who they were, and she went and talked to them, and they were all not really interested in doing anything about it. They didn't grind acorns anymore, of course, or anything like that, so they weren't too interested. and they didn't live near it. And so she finally went to the state legislature and promoted to them that they ought to, that the state ought to buy the property and develop it into a state park because it's such a beautiful place and completely unique, being the huge stone that it was, that had so many, like 1,000 grinding holes in it. It was
more
just
than
more than that, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that it was just something that would be very a treasure for the state. And she finally convinced them, she thinks, and she always said that she, the final straw was that she told them, because they were all good old boys back in those days, and they were hunters and fishermen and stuff, and she says, well, there's really good fishing up in our area, too. And she thinks that was a selling point. But they did buy the property from Jim Scapacito, and he thanked her so much that he knew that it was going to be saved, and he was so thrilled that that it wasn't going to just go and be split up and everything, and it has become the beautiful park that it is. He never did get to see that, but before he died, he knew that it was going to be a beautiful place saved for people to admire and treasure, and that was a wonderful thing. And Jimmy Scapacito was a really nice old man, I remember. And I think that it was just it was a marvelous thing that got done. And my mother remembered him so fondly all the time. And how he, here's an old Italian man that treasured something as unusual as an Indian grinding rock, and wanted it saved for, basically for posterity. And he was a unique and wonderful old man himself. So,
do you remember what his home was like? What the inside of the house was like? Or
not
about that?
Actually, not at all. I don't even remember if I ever went in the house, and maybe I did. I'm sure my mother had been in there. But I don't know if I ever did, because all I remember really is being outside, and I could see me not really wanting to go out inside because I was just this little wild tomboy, even as a, you know, 4-year-old or 5-year-old. And his yard was really kind of cool because it had fig trees, and I loved figs, and when the figs were ripe, I would get to, you know, I could just go and pick figs and eat them, and they're still there. I still go and pick figs in the fall when they're ripe, and also I always wanted to just go visit with the horse, with Black Beauty. I was so horse crazy, and Mom would stay and talk to Jimmy and my brother. I don't even remember Chris being with us all the time, but he was, I'm sure. But I was the horse crazy one, so I would just go and visit with Black Beauty while Mom and Jimmy talked. And so I don't remember ever being inside the house. The house is still standing. It is the office for Chausse Indian Grinding Rock for the state park. And it basically, of course, on the outside looks exactly the same, but the inside, I have no idea. It has a great little basement. And I remember kind of running up and down the steps of the basement. I don't remember going into the basement necessarily, but I remember running up and down the steps. And
was it a working farm? Did it have crops and other animals?
He had... I know he had a big garden, and because he grew the corn. And I think my mom got a few other things from him, too, but the corn was what I always remembered, because ever since then I've wanted to eat Indian corn, and you don't find Indian corn fresh anymore. You find it only dried for decoration, really. But Indian corn was just wonderful to eat. And then, but I know he had a big garden in the back, so I know that, and he had an orchard, a little orchard there, with apples and things like that. And I think my mother got apples for her apples pies from him. And or some of the, you know, some apples from him for apple pies. And I don't remember a lot of other stuff. I was really, I know I wasn't more than 5 or 6 years old when he passed away, because so that was like 1960 or something. So I don't really remember a lot, except that he was just the nicest man to me, and he was just, he'd hold my hand and we'd walk around sometimes. But he was just a very nice guy, and my mom really admired him. And he spoke with an accent, very Italian accent as far as I remember, because he was really from an old Italian family, he and his brother. In fact, as I recall my mother talking about it, I think his brother really, he spoke English, it was real broken English, whereas Jimmy knew English better. He was the younger brother. I heard recently that when the CYA boys from the Pine Grove camp were overbuilding the new bridge across the gully there next to the road into the park between the old house and the park, that they were digging and they found some gold pieces, some gold coins stuck in a pipe or something, buried. I don't know the whole story, but I think it's true. I heard it from somebody that was really reliable, and that they think that it was like a hidden stash from the Scapacino brothers, but I'm not sure of what all has come up. I've never heard anything else about it. In fact, I'd like to find out more about that, see what happened about that, if they got any news. That was just recently. That was like a year ago.
Because that bridge looks fairly...
Oh, yeah, that was just built. That was just built for wheelchair access to the trail.
Mm-hmm.
And it was... I just heard this from Dennis Manor, that they had found some gold there, some gold coins, which I find very fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And at the moment, that's all I can think of this. That was kind of all I remember about Jimmy Scapacino, except for that, you know, we walked around and stuff, but I don't remember lots, I don't remember conversations necessarily or anything, except for that what my mother passed mm-hmm. along to me after that was about the fact that he really wanted the Grinding Rock, his rock, to be saved.
Mm-hmm.
And
through the museum, your mother is still honored for having, for her her participation in getting that legislation through. It's an unusual park because of its small size and the now support of what remains of the descendants of the Miwok are involved in the park.
Which is good.
Yeah. They're right now rebuilding the roundhouse. Were any of those, in your memory, were any of those old relics of the people having been there still there? Were there any old...
Nothing.
Bark, nothing. Just the big oaks.
Just the big oaks and the rock. Just the rock. There was no remains of any sort of structures of any kind on the property at all that I recall. No, nothing.
Yeah, that's where it's...
But if they...
It had never been a permanent site.
No. That was a seasonal resting place for people. They stopped off there to do their grinding during the season when the acorns were ripe, and they would grind. I would imagine for a month or so, and then move on to a better place to be where lower in the
probably lower
elevation, so that they wouldn't be in the snow, because this elevation we still do get snow,
right.
So it wouldn't be a very comfortable place to live during the winter.
Right.
And so it was a huge meeting area for mm-hmm. I'm sure they had a lot of people at the same time, considering how many grinding holes are there. I mean, the how many years would they have had to work that stone to have those
at least
holes? Because those holes are some of them are really deep, and they're beautiful. I mean, gosh, it was just it's just an amazing place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they still are quite beautiful.
I mean, it used to be though, you know, we could walk all over the rock. Now, of course, they don't allow it. And it was so fun to run around on that rock and find the different holes and the pictographs on them and everything. It was just it was really really a fun place to run around and play. And the oak trees were so beautiful, and they still are. And there's several of them have fallen down since I've been alive because they've just gotten so old that they just came to the end of their lives because they're so old. And there were lots of fairy rings. That's a very magical place, I think. I would imagine their medicine people, medicine men, because I'm sure they didn't have medicine women back then. I don't even know if they still do. But they were probably it was kind of a spiritual place, I would imagine, because it felt and feels that way now, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it still feels that way, in spite of all the visiting. Would you say something about the pictographs, please? I think you have an interesting story about the pictographs. Anne, and I think you should fess up to that story.
Well, my mother, being the historian and the protector of history that she always was in my lifetime, always taught me and my brother that you did not deface property. You did not carve your name in trees. You didn't do stuff like that. That was graffiti and not to be done. So my mother, I always thought, was going to be very upset with this, and at an event that I did tell her what happened many, 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 many years later, she laughed, which was really funny. But, I mean, when I was a kid, and I had a boyfriend, I mean, I would take chalk and do AT plus so-and-so and put that on things, but I would never do anything permanent. But one time when I was about, I think probably at least 6 years old, probably first grade, maybe second grade, my cousins from the big city, from the Bay Area, came up and we were visiting, and they were just a few years older than me, and my brother is 3 years older than me, and we were all up having a picnic up at the park. It wasn't a park back then. Well, it did belong to the park back then, but it did, or to the state back then, but it wasn't, you know, developed into a park as of yet. And we were just picnicking up there at the Grinding Rock and having a fun time running around, and the five kids and having a great time, four girls and my brother, and we were just having a great time running all over the place. And they decided to carve their names into the rock. So I did too. And I was just learning how to write in cursive. And so I was writing in cursive, and I never thought anything of it until years later. I forgot all about it, and years later, when the park was in full swing with the museum and everything, I was over there visiting with my mother, and in fact, it was right before my wedding. It was in 1988, now that I think of it, that I was over at the park because we were meeting with White Eagle, who is a Native American man from up around, I think he's from Washington, but he would come down and he had some art in the museum and things, and we were talking to him because he was going to do some flute music for my wedding. And I was looking around and looking at the things that were on display in the museum, and they had this beautiful little poster that I looked at, and it had all the pictographs on it from the rock, and they had just, you know, mapped them out on this poster. And I was looking at it, and all of a sudden I looked in the corner and I said, oh my God, because there was my name written in cursive, A-N-N. There was no E on it. My name is spelled with an E, but I think that by the time I got to the E, I wasn't pushing as hard with my rock that I was carving it into the rock with, so the E may have, you know, not really shown up anymore, but that was my name. And I looked at it and I said, oh my God, they put my name as part of the pictographs on the poster. And I was like, oh my gosh, no. My mother was, I didn't even know what to say, but I thought I'd better tell my mom. And I brought my mom over to it, and I showed it to her, and I had her look at it without saying anything. She's looking at it, and I go, Mom, do you see what I see? She goes, not really. And I pointed it out to her. I said, Mom, I carved my name in the rock. And she looked at it, and she says, oh, my goodness. And she started laughing, which I thought was amazing, because I thought she was going to spank me, and I was like 30 years old. But she thought it was very funny, really. I mean, I don't think at the time she would have, when I was doing it, she would have thought it was funny if she'd caught us. But at that point, she did think it was funny because it was now part of the Indian graffiti. Mm-hmm. And, yep, it's on the poster.
Yeah, and it is. They do acknowledge that there was graffiti from before the area became a park. But that's true of many, many parks in the United States system, because even the people who came through in the 1800s did graffiti on pictographs.
Well, that's what
they would draw them over there, because they knew that if the Native Americans had been able to carve something, that they could carve something too. So they carve their names and the date they had passed through.
Well,
it's not unusual.
Well, to a certain extent, and really, the pictographs from the Native Americans was graffiti also.
Yes.
I mean, all of it is graffiti. The drawings in the French caves, the cave, you know, from the Neanderthals and all, is graffiti.
Some of it.
In its own way. It's not exactly, I mean, it depicted stories to, you know, and things like that, but yeah, it was somebody saying, I was here. And that's sort of what I was
there's
too,
evidence that on old Greek and Roman walls that there was enormous amounts of announcements and graffiti and messages left for other people.
Well, I think that was what my mother decided, that it was okay that my name, and plus she thought it was just funny as heck that it was on the poster, and that nobody had realized that that was actually a name rather than a snake or something like that, because it is very clearly A-N-N.
Right. It is very easy.
And when I saw it, I was absolutely flabbergasted and kind of appalled at myself.
On the other hand, it passes through your mother's involvement, because certainly her name isn't there.
Nope.
And yet, without her intervention at that exact time, it would not become
would
a
not
park.
Have been a park.
It may have later on, but maybe not. If it so took development, it might have become something the way that it is in Hawaii, where some of the most sacred grounds are in development with big barbed wire things around them and no longer
it's so
have
sad.
Their... Yeah, it is sad. It's
very
sad.
It's
sad to even drive by them. You feel the sadness of the whole thing being isolated from the culture, and your mom was instrumental in saving that. So I think it's a very important part of the history. It shows that very positive unity with the people can produce something quite important, and that other generations might find it so, because certainly the people who still do big time up there and so on in the fall find it very important.
But what's really interesting is there had never been a big time in up there at this park in ever until just recently.
Yeah, but that's
not
my
since
point.
Back in the day when they,
yeah.
I mean, I'm not even sure they had a big, well, it was a big time because that was what they were doing. That's what they met there to grind their stones, and they would have probably had music and things
mm-hmm.
like that way back in the ancient times. But in recent years, in the last, you know, 50 years, there never was a big time until,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm 58 years old, and they've only been having big time for these recent years since it's been a park. And actually, in it's been a park since it's belonged to the state since the late 50s, early 60s, and it wasn't until the 70s that they started having big time.
which
over there.
Around the state was a time when there was a renewal
of the cultural values.
And fortunately, there had been places preserved where those things could happen.
And if it hadn't
and
happened.
That's what your mom had done.
That's what she did.
It was not a time when the people presently there, for whatever debilitating reasons, because there certainly were plenty that had continued to happen. I think that the fact that then the next generation they had more permission within themselves to continue looking back at their heritage
with pride.
They had a place. They had a place then to go.
Yep.
You know, certainly when I got out here in the 70s, it was really going on around that time that the people were reestablishing their heritage and trying to take over Alcatraz Rock and to have a place right here that had been saved for them for just such a day. Was a very important contribution your mother made.
Actually,
a very important contribution.
It's interesting.
That she and that old Italian fellow made for those people. They made something that would be timeless. That was didn't fit the times even. But
yep,
was
no,
timeless.
Not at that time.
But was timeless.
Yes, it is, and it is now. Yep. The 70s were an interesting time for that kind of heritage hunting for people because that was when. Like the book Roots was written, and Malcolm X, and for the black people too. So it was. I mean, I think some other books were written in the late 60s, but they weren't as
universal
because the civil rights situation was still shaky and things. But by the 70s, things were getting. Pride of self was really becoming okay, and. Which is interesting because a different story altogether from the Native Americans and the Miwok up here was the fact that in the mid-70s, Alex Haley, who wrote the book Roots, he was having trouble writing it, finishing it in time for its publication date, and he actually came up here to Volcano and stayed for several weeks. And almost, I think that it was at least 3 weeks. He stayed here in Volcano in the local schoolhouse, which had been made into a home built designed by a relatively well-known architect now named Beverly Willis from San Francisco, who knew Alex, and she gave him permission to come up here and stay and be kind of quiet and have. The time to finish his book, and he wrote most of the end of Roots right here in Volcano, in the our one room schoolhouse.
Just about the time that the Native American peoples were starting to revive their traditions values, and
so that was
an exciting time.
Yeah.
And that's amazing that Volcano was involved then. In some ways, then on both levels,
yeah,
a
Alex
little tiny place like
yep.
this, little tiny town.
We became really good friends with Alex, actually. He ate at their restaurant, the Jug and Rose, a number of times. Well, a lot, actually. And had Mom fix dinner for him and things like that, so that he wouldn't have to be cooking all the time because he was trying to keep his mind on his book. And so we have autographed copies of his books and things. And he, very, very nice man. Very nice man. And it was a... wonderful experience knowing him because he was interesting to talk to. I remember that he was because I was
sure.
old enough. I was in high school then, so it was quite an interesting thing to get to know someone like that, and later to realize, my gosh, this man is now world famous,
internationally known, of course.
And he was just a very impressive person. And I feel very lucky that I got to know him. So, yep, Volcano's kind of an interesting place. It's drawn some very, very interesting people to it. And I haven't met all of them, of course, but my mom and dad, my mom was some of the reason why some of these people came to Volcano was actually because of my mother. In the 60s, early 60s, and I don't remember meeting him at all, but I know the photographer
Ansel Adams.
Ansel Adams, yes. My goodness, I can't really thank you for reminding me. I know I told the story earlier to you.
Yes.
And he knew my mother from when she was in college at UC Berkeley. And she used to babysit some of his very best friend's children at a house somewhere near the university. And she would, when they would go to like Tahoe and places, she would actually go with them on a number of occasions and be their, like, the nanny for the children while they were off, you know, having a, you know, enjoying their adult entertainments and of whatever kind they were doing, and Ansel took photographs all of them, of course, all the time. And so my mother knew him from then, and when she moved up here, he came up and visited her and took photographs here in Volcano and used to photograph one specific tree my mother, you know, knew that he had taken photographs of. And in the late 60s or early 70s, it was coming down. It was dying. It was a black locust tree, and it was dying, and it so that they were just, they the townspeople decided to cut it down. And when somebody told her they were cutting it down, she ran out of the jug and rose. She told me this story. I didn't remember this. And she went down and she says, "You can't cut that tree up for firewood. You have to leave this tree." And so there is still the tree, the main part of the trunk is laying on the side of the sidewalk, right directly across from the Volcano Theater amphitheater. And she planted it with succulents and bulbs and things, and it's now a natural planter.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the remains of the tree that Ansel Adams used to photograph, one of the trees that he photographed, that was here right in town. And I have photographs that I found that my mother took, I think, of the tree, with the tree in the background. So I know what the tree looked like later, before it got cut down, after he had taken photographs. But and the tree isn't there now, of course.
Do you have any memories of him?
No. I do not remember meeting him, although I may have met him, but I don't remember at all. I just know the mother has, you know, told me that story and why she saved the tree, wouldn't let them cut it up for firewood, and that they were, you know, good friends. And I've since I've been an adult, now I'm starting to try to figure out how to find out, like, from his family, his remaining family since he's been gone, if they have any photographs of Volcano that he took that have never been really published anywhere that I've seen. Because I don't think that any of those photographs are any of his most famous photographs, because otherwise I probably would have recognized him or seen him. But then again, I don't know. So, but yep.
Yeah, the gallery is in, and the institute is in Yosemite.
Right.
So, yeah. That would be worth following up on.
I haven't been to Yosemite in years. And the last time I was in, I've only been to Yosemite a couple of times. And they didn't have that museum as well put together as it is now.
It's beautifully put together now. The archives there can be researched if you have a good reason for it. So it sounds to me like it would be something to take a good, let them know who you are and arrange for a time that you could do a trip there, because they'd probably help house you and everything to be able to go through and try to identify pictures for them.
That's a possibility.
That they might not
know
where they were from.
And I would probably be able to recognize them. The last time I was in Yosemite, I've only been there twice. And the one time was in 1977. And then after that, I just went through one time with some friends, and I haven't really been able to, and we didn't stop at the museums or anything. In fact, I'm not sure if they were even open at the time.
That gallery would delight you. They'd have to drag you from it.
You know, I want to go so badly. My husband and I both want to go down there again. We just haven't had the opportunity for years to go down there. So.
Well, let's try to
Let's try to go. That would be fun.
Yeah, it would be
interesting if we could find photographs.
I'm sure that you could. I bet you could. And I remember when I was there, there was something written there that said that, you know, if you know of archives, you know, it's an whole institute now. So they're looking for people who can go through things that they don't recognize and say, and you would
maybe
you might
identify
see
something
like the tree, or you might or buildings from volcano, and you could say this is our ask the office. This is things that they might not.
That's true. Because my mother said that. I mean, he took photographs around the area, but the tree was important because it was right here in town, and it was the one thing she could preserve, knowing that it was, you know, it had, it should be recognized as what it is. Actually, I've been.
There is a plaque there. Right?
No, there is no plaque.
There needs to be a plaque.
No, there's never been a plaque on that tree, as far as I know.
There needs to be.
Oh, there needs to be one. Yes, I actually, that's very important. Yes, you're right. I'm going to have to talk to, I don't know who to talk to about getting a plaque on there. Maybe I'm supposed to make the plaque myself. I don't know. But we should have a plaque on that tree for as long as it lasts. It's going
everybody
to.
Everybody knows Ansel Adams.
Well, yes.
This was a tree he photographed.
This is a tree that he photographed when it was standing. And maybe if we could find the picture of the tree in the archives there in Yosemite, maybe that would be something.
Yes,
it is very exciting.
Right, and then they could get photos of it, and they could sell them to places like the
general
store.
Postcards.
Right, postcards
yes.
of the tree.
Yes,
right.
The tree that Ansel Adams photographed.
You know, that's
we
kind of
almost have rights
project.
To it. We almost have rights to it.
That is a worthy project.
It is a very worthy project. Awesome project.
I think so, too.
Maybe I should get postcards. I could make money off. I could get rich.
You know, and that is not an impossible goal. I'm not joking. That is not an impossible goal.
Oh, anyway.
You know,
but that
definitely, as you get further away from things becoming collectibles and onto them becoming more antique, people want this information more because there's less and less of it, really, as time goes by.
Well,
and so to have, and the fact that it's still there,
oh, hopefully,
the planter,
oh yes,
story,
yes, and it is the planter is going to eventually go back
right,
to the
exactly.
earth.
So until it does, you should be even.
Yeah, it's true.
Taking photographs occasionally of it.
Of it, yes, there are a few. We have a few. Actually, I do have some photographs of it. As
you know, I think you need to just establish
start
a folder
little
folder.
Ansel Adams tree.
Right. Yeah.
Mom and Ansel
and
Adams tree.
And if you can find that is an artifact. From that
of
time,
interesting.
Out of it, that has anything to do with Ansel Adams and your mom, I would definitely try to put it into a folder.
You know, that's the only thing that I know about Ansel Adams and my mother is this. I don't know if there's anything else from previous to that, except that she knew him, she liked him, he liked her. There was a friendship there.
I bet there's something.
I actually don't even know the name, although I know she told me. I don't even remember the name of the family friend of his friends in Berkeley
that
he
kind of thing
babysat
even
for.
Come up at some point.
Maybe
a letter that was written to her.
Very possibly. I don't know. I haven't found anything.
Card or something.
I haven't found anything yet, and I have been. I've got zillions of things to go through with my mother's stuff and my dad's stuff.
Well, but sometimes when you have a focus like that, then it pops out.
Actually, I've already found a few things that are of interest from other parts of stories that my mother had. My mother and father also, although my mother was told more of the stories and had, so I got more memories of her stories, but my dad had stories too that were of interest of the people that he knew and that he had kept in touch with and things like that over the years.
I think that why don't we and well I think would like to conclude our hour here. We've
right
got
now.
About 20 more minutes. No, I'd like to about 20 more minutes if you're up to it. We've already done 40 minutes.
Really?
Really.
Wow.
So if we could do another, you know, 20 more even of your mom.
Okay.
Then we could do the next hour of everything that you remember with your dad.
Well, some of what I can remember.
Right.
If you could stop it for a second.
On this broadcast, I'm going to be recording an interview with Ann Thibault Sprague. And we're going to be talking together about her mother, Muriel. Ann's mom was not a typical mother, I think, from everything that Ann has told me and that other people have told me about her mother. Her mother was a pioneer in many ways of thinking about being
a woman in a mountain rural town. And when I say that, I don't say it lightly. What I mean is, and I'm sure that you're going to be able to reflect this for me, Anne, she was a creative and original thinker in a time when women were not appreciated and acknowledged as creative and original thinkers politically or in a civic action sort of way in these foothills of the Sierras, much less anywhere else in California or perhaps even in the nation. So I would like, Anne, for you to introduce yourself to these people by telling them a little bit about your own history. You were born and raised where, Anne?
Well, I was born in, I was raised in Volcano, California. And I was almost born in Volcano, but my mother actually went into labor with me, had her water break even to get that personal, too much information, but in Volcano. But then my uncle Bill drove my mother all the way to Oakland to actually have me. So she was in labor, I would imagine, the whole entire trip, and this was in 1955, so we're talking a bit of a drive, and had me at Peralta Hospital in Oakland, but then within a few days brought me back to Volcano.
Was this already somewhat an unusual thing to do, to travel that far to have your baby?
In my mind it is. I would say that even nowadays would be very weird.
Yeah.
I mean, I drove... When I had my son, we did drive from Volcano to Lodi to have me, mm-hmm. I mean, have my son, but that's only, you know, less than an hour. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking at least a three-hour drive to Oakland to have me. So, of course, I mean, labor can go on for a long time, mm-hmm. but still, that's kind of extreme. But then Amador County was not exactly known for having wonderful and progressive medical facilities, even though they did have a hospital here in Amador County at the time. But I think my mother was a little leery of that.
She sounds like a person who made up her mind, and that's what she wanted to do, and people facilitated it. Your uncle drove her all the way there.
Yep. I don't even think they questioned it. I think that she just said, that's where we're going, and that's where they went.
Okay, now let's take that spirit, and we're talking here a little bit about the historic spirit of women who have helped form this county, Amador County. And let's take a little bit of that spirit and talk then about some of the things that your mother accomplished in her wonderful lifetime, living not just in Volcano, but her effect on the whole county. What strikes you? What comes first to mind? What do you think when you think things my mom did that were unusual and creative and accomplished something in this county? What comes to mind first?
Well, a couple of things, actually. One being that one of her first things that she wanted to do in Volcano after they'd lived there a few years was open up an ice cream parlor, which I've spoken of, I think, before in an interview, but she opened up an ice cream parlor in December in Volcano, which was a little, you know, it was a very small town and really didn't have a lot of tourism at that time, or in, I think it was 1952, or actually 1954 is when she opened the Jug and Rose, or the Stone Jug, as she called then. And everybody in the area thought she was crazy, first of all, opening an ice cream parlor in the first place, but then doing it in December in a little tiny town that was off the beaten track, and then made a great success of it over the years. Also,
well, let's talk a little bit about the Jug and Rose, because it was one of the things that charmed me when I first came into Volcano. You're looking at a stone building that actually had not been there, but looks like it had been there going all the way back to the gold rush in Volcano. Where did that stone building come from?
Mom,
it became the Jug and Rose.
Well, you're right. It was a vacant lot when Mom and Dad first moved there. I can't remember. I know I could find out, and all of us could find out, what was there on that lot originally in the 1800s. But it was a vacant lot. They purchased the property. They then purchased the stonework, the building itself, off of a piece of property about 8 miles away at Upper Rancheria, which was an old mining town also that was north of Volcano. And it was the stonework and the ruin of an old saloon and store that was called the Jug Saloon. And they dismantled the building stone by stone while drawing a template of how it was put together, so that they could then go back down into Volcano and rebuild the building to the exact design that it was originally, so that the windows and the doorways, which had stone arches over them, would have the keystones in the proper places, and the rocks didn't need to be chipped or anything to fit exactly together. They just were already fitted together and just needed the mortar to be put between them.
I understand your mom did a lot of that building.
Well, she said very proudly that she was the hod carrier.
Yeah.
And mixed up the mortar and brought buckets of mortar to the guys setting the stones, and was the critical person that watched everybody do it and make sure they did it right. In fact, when one of the masons that was working on it, well, one of the helpers, because my Uncle Bill and my father and my mother were all working on it, when one of them started to chip one of the stones to make it fit, she practically took his hammer out of his hand and said, "No way, you can't do that. That's, if it's not fitting, it's not in the right place." And so she did do a lot of the work that helped to build the stone jug, is what it was called at that time.
Mm-hmm.
The stone jug confectionery.
How many years did your parents have the Jug and Rose? As a restaurant and a...
For 30 years.
30 years. That's amazing. So 54 through 84.
Actually, we actually sold it in 1985.
In 1985. So you grew up in that store.
I did. I grew up running around in that little place.
And a lot of people grew up eating a lot of ice cream in that place.
Yes. It was definitely not a dieter's heaven.
So what kind of things did they serve? You have a list here of things that the Amador County Board of Supervisors, there's a resolution, it's number 09-059, and it's a resolution honoring Ann's mother, Muriel Thibault, for her tireless commitment to the County of Amador and the community of Volcano. And one of the paragraphs is about the Jug and Rose. Can you read that for us, please?
Whereas
Muriel and Jock,
that's her
father, that's Ann's father, Muriel's husband.
Whereas Muriel and Jock, along with their friend and business partner, Bill Whittle, were proprietors of the Jug and Rose in Volcano for 30 years, and during that time saw some very colorful and famous guests, including John Wayne, John Ford, Ken Curtis, Sourdough Jack Mabey, Charles Camp, editor of John Noble's Journal, Ansel Adams, Jester Hairston, Carolyn Keene, Huell Hauser, General Harry the Horse Liversedge, U.S. Marine Corps, Joe Rosenthal, who was the World War II civilian photographic reporter raising the flag on Iwo Jima, and whereas folks came from far and wide to enjoy sourdough pancake breakfasts, delectable ice cream sundaes, specialty teas, and delightful lunches.
See, to me this is amazing because it's almost like she used this place as her political base. This is where she got to be known and where people would identify her as being part of the heart of this little community of Volcano. Am I right about that?
I would say definitely so. She met some very interesting people there, many of them by accident. And then, of course, some by having other people say, you need to go there. And then people that came back. And that was kind of how the business went, was, of course, people saying this was a great place and bring more people back. But Mother, she got a lot of things done in the place
mm-hmm.
when talking with people and stuff like that. She was, early in the 60s, she was also the first woman director of the Amador County Chamber of Commerce.
Right, which is a significant thing to say about her, because this is, in many ways, a county that has a rich family network of families that have held all of the political positions one after the other.
And they were all men.
And they were men.
Or almost all men.
Yeah.
Well, I think it was the running of the Jug and Rose that put her in the position where she could be made director, because she was making it so important to have tourism as the one of the more important aspects of Amador County advertising. I mean, that was what she saw as being the life of Amador County, was bringing tourists and people up here who appreciated seeing and hearing and experiencing the history of such a rich gold mining area.
And I'm sure she was very remarkable in that role. I saw the video that you shared with me of her interview with Huell Hauser on Backroads of California. Wasn't that the one that you
actually
showed me?
It was called Road Trips.
That was the Road Trips.
Road Trips.
Okay.
He did the programs, the California's Gold, and
okay.
then he did another program called Road Trips.
Did that eventually become Backroads?
No. Backroads is a different program altogether.
Okay. Okay. Well, it was a fascinating film. There's no doubt about that, because not only did she bring out her personality as an incredible speaker to the history of the area, but she brought every personality out on the street. She literally brought her neighbors and friends out into the street to talk to the rest of the state about the richness of their cultural and historic background in Volcano. It was a beautiful segment. It was really interesting to watch. And her personality was so sparkly and animated, and
she was pretty old there too.
Yeah, she was. It wasn't like she was, and she was not in any way apologizing for that either.
Nope.
She had lived a long time, and if she felt like sitting down for a minute during any part of the interview, she did. She had command of even the media when she was talking with people. Very powerful lady. Could you speak, please, to her work in establishing Chausey Grinding Rock State Park? And I will read again from her Amador County Board of Supervisors, whereas, because it states it so well. We're moving on down. Oh, there it is. Okay. Whereas
Muriel Thiebaud played an important role in stimulating interest in establishing a state historic park, later known as Chausey Indian Grinding Rock State Park in Volcano, California.
Now, that's all that they say about it. But I think what is significant about that is to know that part of your childhood was visiting the man who owned this place that eventually became Grinding Rock State Park and owned the rock that we are talking about, the rock where the Miwok Indian women of the central foothills would gather together at a time of the year to grind the seeds that had come to harvest and the acorns that had come to harvest for storage and eventually towards making the mushes that were a huge part of their cultural food, of the food that they depended on to make it through every season. So
acorns,
this was an
especially.
Amazing, especially the acorns, and that those the beautiful old oaks are still there with it. They produce the acorns that these women ground. And tell the story, please, I love this story, of your mom heading to Sacramento to speak to the legislators about creating this park. What was it she promised those guys?
Well, she went down with I'm sure her research was probably very extensive as to what she could find out about the history of the area and the Miwok in the area and the usage of the rock and the she, like you said, she was wanting to save the rock for Jim Scapacino, who owned it. He was a very elderly man. He was close to the end of his life, and he was so worried that because he didn't have children or anything to hand it down to, he was concerned about what was going to happen to it. There was a local man who actually lived in an adjacent piece of property that was a realtor and all, and he was very interested in the property to subdivide. And all, and this was in the early 60s, and late 50s, early 60s. And so she had been asked by him to please, you know, find a way to save the rock. Well, she decided that the best way to do it was to have the state buy it and make it into a state park. I mean, she was very appreciative of all our national and state parks all over the country, and so she felt that this was an amazing piece of property with this enormous stone on it. So she went down there with her research and she started telling them, I'm sure she spoke very eloquently of the value of the rock and the history of it and the beauty of the area and all, and they looked on it, I think, pretty favorably, but they were still hemming and hawing about it. But Mother kind of looked at them, and she knew a little bit about our local legislature and the men who sat on the seats, and she knew that they were a bunch of old-time good old boys who did a lot of hunting and fishing. And so she said, and by the way, we have a lot of really good fishing up in our area. And she feels that that was really what their deciding point was, that they could all come up there and go fishing really easily. And it was a good place to come and visit. So I think Mom really always thought that that was the deciding factor, was that the fishing was good in Sutter Creek and our neighboring lakes and streams. So looked on it favorably and decided to purchase the property.
I think that we have to realize that this was before there was a big movement throughout the entire country to have our Native American people rise up and utilize what was becoming for them an important agenda of reclaiming lands in legal and beneficial ways for the tribal peoples that had gone through severe genocides and terrible historic times, and were reclaiming their peoplehood by having had children and, you know, new generations coming forward saying, what is our history? Where are our people? They were just beginning to do that.
I don't even think at that time they were doing that.
Right.
They were I think it was years later mm-hmm. that they started mm-hmm. to be more interested in finding their more about their histories.
It was definitely beginning in parts of the country. Out here in California, I think it took a longer time because the rancherias had such small populations.
They did.
And had lost much of their land. So that your mother took her little self. This is, by the way, not a big Amazon of a lady. This is a slight little feisty lady who looked like she could have been dainty, but was not at all. She looked like she could have been, you know, someone who just would have been a nice housefrau and maybe run her restaurant nicely, but she was not a...
Definitely not an Amazon.
No.
She
did not have that kind of presence. Her presence came from personality and from will, that she could think to herself forward in that kind of way and think, maybe this land could have many uses for the people who had this land in the first place, was a very forward-thinking thing to do, and that she helped a man who wanted it to be that way, the man who actually owned the land, was a special thing for its time. It seems now we look at it and it seems like, well, of course you'd do that, but we have very different relationships now with the Native Americans throughout this country than we had at that time. They were much more stereotypical, I think, relationships we had with those people during that time. So it was a brilliant move, and has opened the door to a lot of dialogue between the state and the Native Americans in this area. You know, it's not yet totally resolved what people would like to do with any of these lands and where the ownership really lies. It's not been resolved, and it's going to be a problem and a benefit to keep moving to reconstructing what this should really be in this state. But she was a pioneer doing that. It was a pioneer thing to do.
Yep.
Yeah, very much so. Is there anything else you'd like to tell us about her that fits this notion that I have about her pioneer spirit? She didn't live in Pioneer 15 minutes away, though. That volcanic personality.
Yes, she did have a volcanic personality.
That anything about her accomplishments that you would like to say? Because this broadcast intends to say, you know, there are people who came before us, there are women who came before us who did some really amazing things in our counties to be progressive for their times, to reclaim old buildings, to reclaim the history as it really was, to preserve history as it was. Your mom was an historian, a living historian in many ways. She created ways for people to access this history. So anything else that you'd like to say about her accomplishments?
Well, one of the things was that practically next door to the little Jug and Rose that she built was a little tiny building that was just kind of an old, almost looked probably like a shack, sort of. And the old owner wanted to burn it down one day, and he was about to, and she looked at him and she says, don't you dare, I'll buy it. And so she ended up buying it from him because it was the old volcano assay office. And it is an original building from the late 1800s, 1871 or 1872, mm-hmm. I think it was, built with the square nails that were made mm-hmm. right there in Volcano at the blacksmith shops. And the building is still... It's a little wood building that's still standing, and
yeah, that's on the corner.
That's on the corner, almost on the corner of Main Street and Consolation Street, mm-hmm. and it is. She was just saying, my God, you can't just burn down this building. It's a historical landmark. And unfortunately, it still has not been named officially a historic landmark, although I think it should be, and I'm not sure how to go about getting it done, but maybe eventually it will be. But she did save it, and she was very, I don't think that's part of the...
No, it does say, though, that your mom...
Saved buildings.
Saved buildings. Okay, basically.
A number of buildings.
It says, whereas Burial and Jock were instrumental in restoration of
five of the 11 historic buildings in Volcano and donated the property, which is now home to the Cobblestone Theater, to the Volcano Theater Company.
Yeah, so they...
That was one of the things, yes.
Yes.
That was the store down the street.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a stone building. It was totally different. So, but yes, Mom was... She didn't want the buildings to continue falling down. She wanted to keep them standing instead and try to either restore them or keep them at least so people could still look at them. And as it was, she really wanted to restore them to being of use to someone. And so that was, I mean, our buildings in our historic towns and things in this area in Amador County and all are only, you know, a 100 or so years old, but that's really old to us.
Yes, to California.
And to have them still standing, even if they're starting to crumble, she wanted to keep them from crumbling anymore. So she did.
If you wanted your mother to be remembered and wanted it to be said as simply as possible, how would you think you would like to have it said? What would you like her remembered for? Perhaps most, but if not most, then most often. How would you like her to be remembered?
Well, I wish I had it in my pocket, but she was very, very progressive, really. She wanted to go forward and have people appreciate, you know, new things, but she was also a historian, and so what was the wording that she used? She promoted historically minded progress. So she didn't expect things to stand still. She wanted things to progress, to be financially a better off place and people, but she didn't want it to be over the rubble of history. She wanted it to be all in, built up and appreciated.
That's well said. I very much like how you said that about her. And it fits that lady who had that wheelbarrow and the mortar and the
the hog carrier.
The hog carrier who made sure that the building was saved. And it's still there, Jug and Rose in Volcano. It's a bakery. Bakery still. Still has this beautiful counter of marble. And
local marble.
Local marble. And there may be the best place to sit and have yourself a donut and a cup of coffee someday and think on Muriel Pebo and what she contributed to Volcano, California, and to the county of Amador. Thank you very much, Anne, for telling us more about your mom.
Thanks, Kat.
Oh, I appreciate it.
Okay, this is April 25th. We're recording with Ms. Thibault again, Stan Thibault. And I've asked her today to talk about Volcano and her childhood. And we're focusing on the older people who lived around her and her childhood memories of them. Some of these people may have been already interviewed by Cedric in the past. Some of them possibly have no record of having been here at all in the Amador Historic Society sense. But we're going to go around the block from a child's perspective and reflect upon her memories about these people. And you can start anywhere in your neighborhood and in your childhood that you wish.
Okay, well, let's see. I'll start after I was 9 years old up at the house that my parents had for the rest of their lives up on Consolation. So across the street was some of my favorite people, two of my favorite people, Charlie and Irene Cook. And he built the house that was across the street. It had steps up on it, up to it, and it's still there almost exactly the same way. And he had these beautiful two little cement deer in the front yard. One was lying down and one was standing, and I always used to ride that standing one all the time. It was just lots of fun. And he let me. It was pretty strong. I think later on when it did get chipped up by all of us riding it, it had angle iron in it or something or whatever. But anyway, rode his deer, played in his yard, and Irene always had iced tea over there in the summer in their spring room in the back. She's really... They had really nice things, and they would always welcome me in, and I was always, didn't matter what I was doing or how dirty I was from playing or whatever, I could always go in there and get a cold drink, and or in the sun, in the winter, sit by the fire in the kitchen, and she made good things to eat. I don't remember things really what she made, but she was just a sweetheart to me. Irene and Charlie were good. Charlie did wood. He was a carpenter. And we have a desk that he made and a chest of drawers that he made. And,
what years would these have been, Anne? Just generally.
In the early 60s, although I knew him my whole life, I mean, from day one, pretty much, because he was living here, the Cooks lived here for many, many years, generations, here in town, and Charlie walked all over town and got around and did stuff, and he was kind of maybe part of the town council, whatever council there was for Volcano at that time. And I think when I was, I remember I actually have a picture of him and me standing on top of the stone water fountain over by the trading post, between the trading post and the town hall, standing up on top of it, raising the American flag on the 4th of July, 1966, maybe, 64, 65, 66. It was a flag that I had written to... Our flag in town was really worn out, and my mother encouraged me to write a letter to one of our assemblyman or somebody. I have the name. Biz Johnson is who it was. And ask him to send us the flag, the town a flag that had flown over the state capitol. And so he did, of course, because they do that. And so Charlie and I raised the flag over the town on the 4th of July. It's a cool picture of us. We were good friends. They were, even though I mean, they liked me. I could hang out there a lot. I picked flowers there for the Jug and Rose, my mom's restaurant, ice cream parlor. I picked violets, lots of violets. Yeah. Irene had lots of violets. You walk out the back door of the screened-in porch, and it would just smell like violets outside. Mm-hmm. It was so, so nice. And so that was Charlie and Irene. I don't...
And the last name was Cook. Do the Cooks still own that property?
The Cooks do not own that house anymore. In fact, they don't... The Cooks, even though across the street... Toby Cook, who is Charlie's son and is now 92, I think. He lives across the street, but he rents a little house from some other people. They sold Toby's brother, and he sold Charlie and Irene's house a number of years ago to some newcomers here in town. And so it no longer is in the family. Kind of unfortunate, but that's what happens sometimes. I guess the rest of the family, the sons and daughters, didn't really want to hang on to it. So it was a way to keep everybody living comfortably, I think. Excuse me, I have sinus problems. My allergies are driving me crazy.
You still sound fine.
And next door to the Charlie and Irene was Gert and Arnold Jonas, and they are not sure about Arnold Jonas. I think Jonas is an old name in town, maybe, but Gert was from the Veroni family, and that family goes way back here in Volcano. And in fact, she had a sister, I think Blanche, I think was her sister, and I'll get to her later, Blanche and Ernie Pojo. But Gert and Arnold were really nice to me. Gert didn't get along with my mother very much, though. they clashed. They had issues because Mom was very much of a wave maker and wanted Volcano to be back on the map, and Gert was kind of ran the town, and she sort of, they just clashed. But Gert taught me how to knit when I was a little bit older. Taught me how to knit, which I've probably forgotten all of that, but I did knit with her. Now, she was the postmaster here in Volcano at the time, and so I'd go down and sit in the post office with her. And she taught me to knit, and it was really fun. And she thought I was pretty funny, kind of a hellraiser. I was a brat. And Arnold was really nice. Arnold was just a really nice guy, but I don't remember a lot about Arnold, really.
You know what his work had been?
He worked for PG&E. I'm pretty positive he worked for PG&E. And, they had a daughter named Pat, Judy, who was a lot older than me. She was a teenager, but she was nice, but I didn't know her very well as a teenager because they all hung out together and I was just a little kid. And next door to them, oh, wait a minute, I'll go back. That Arnold and Gert's house, when they passed away and all, Judy actually did come back and live in their house. and lived out her life and then passed away several years ago. And her son, Jim, and his girlfriend now live in that house. So it stayed in the family. So that's kind of nice. So then next door to the Jonas house is Bert and Eleanor Craw live there, and their daughter Mary. And Mary was around the same age as Judy. But Mary actually played with me and my brother a little bit now and then. Maybe she was a little bit younger than Judy. Yeah, I think she must have been a little bit younger than Judy. And, but Bert, I can't remember where he worked. Eleanor was a housewife, but she, later on, she opened a, out of her garage, she opened up a yarn shop, and because she, as well as Gert, knitted and crocheted and stuff, so she had a little yarn, Eleanor's yarn shop, right there in Volcano. And they were really nice. They lived there my whole life, but I understand that they moved to Volcano when Mary was like, I don't know, 7 or so, 8, 9, I'm not sure, I would have to ask Mary. Mary lives there still with her dad. Her mother passed away. She had died of some sort of cancer back in the late 70s, I think. And but Mary takes care of her dad. Her dad is 89, 90. I think he's older than 89. I think he's in his early 90s now. And I think he's 96, actually.
Wow.
I think that's how old he is. And so Mary takes care of him. And her brother lives with Jackson, David, with his wife. And next door, on the corner of Constellation and Plug Street, on the northeast corner, was Sadie Grillo. And Sadie, you'll be able to hear more about when we interview Terry Grillo, which is her grandson. But Sadie was really a neat old lady. And she was an old lady, and she was really nice. And she had a big yard, and so I could go over there and play. I kind of ran loose in Volcano I'm talking about kind of when I was, my parents built their house up the street up on Constellation when I was 9 years old in 1964. But no matter what age I was, when I was actually running around, I was like from about the age of 3 on, I was kind of loose because there was hardly any traffic through town except for locals, and they didn't drive fast like they do nowadays. So I just kind of wandered around, did whatever I wanted. If I needed something or got hurt, skinned up or something like that, all I had to do is go knock on a door, and all my neighbors would, you know, take me in and band-aid me up or whatever needed to be done and give me a drink of water or whatever, or call my mother if they needed to. And if my mother started looking for me, she just called a few places and eventually she'd find me. Because someone would have noticed that I was running around somewhere loose. So Sadie was really a neat lady. And she came from a family, Sadie Grillo. And she actually was from a very old family here in town. They, in fact, they owned the grocery store. The Grillo family owned the grocery store back in the 1850s.
Oh, my.
50s? I think so. And then if you continued up Plug Street, on the east side of Plug Street, the next house was Ernie and Blanche Pojo. And their kids were Peter Pojo, who was born in 1932, I think, or 30s. He just told me what year he's. I have it written down someplace. He's like 76, so that's not 1930s. Something like that. Anyway, he's Peter was the oldest, and then Patty is a couple years younger than him, and Gary was the youngest, and he's like the class of 65 or 64, 63, 64, or 65 of high school. I'm not sure which one. So they were all way older than me. I mean, I was born in 1955, so I didn't hang out with any of those guys. But Ernie, at the time when I was growing up, owned the grocery store. And Blanche was a housewife, but she was Gert Jonas's sister. So she was another Baroni. So that was a local old family. And Ernie Poggio, I don't know where we will be interviewing Peter Poggio for sure, and possibly Patty and Gary, but Peter will be able to tell us a lot about Ernie and Blanche, his mom and dad. And he has actually some movies that he wants to show us too. And but Ernie was really, really neat, and I always loved Ernie. He ran the grocery store, and the grocery store was so, it was real active then, because we all had, everybody in town had a charge account here, so that we could come down. There was a Safeway in Jackson, I think, or there was a grocery store in Jackson, for sure, and then later on, I know there was a Safeway from a pretty young age, somewhere in the 60s or something, maybe Safeway opened, but we did a lot of shopping here anyway. I mean, because, you know, I mean, he always had lots of good stuff in here, and he always had this huge, must have been, I don't know, 3 feet across, no, maybe 2 feet across. I guess it was only about 2 feet across. Big wheel of what my dad would call rat cheese, because it was really sharp cheddar cheese, and it was a big wheel in, you know, wax, and he would, if I came in here, running in here, and I was hungry, he'd give me a little piece of cheese to eat if I wanted it. But one of the things I remembered about Ernie was really fun, because I don't know why I thought this was real at the time, but my mom had a collection of buttons, because she sewed. And I would abscond with some of her buttons, and I would come down here to the grocery store, and I would exchange buttons. I would pay for candy bars and stuff and sodas with buttons. And Ernie would actually take the buttons, and he would sometimes, if I gave him a big button, he would sometimes give me a little button for change. And everything, I mean, it was like I was buying things with buttons, and for years I did that. And it wasn't until I was a young teenager that I found out that all those things that I was buying were put on my parents' bill. Good God, how many hundreds of dollars must I have spent on buttons? And that he would give the buttons back to my mom periodically. But he'd keep enough so that I'd have change in buttons.
That is a great story.
And I couldn't believe it. It was so wonderful. Ernie was just so sweet. His kids never knew that story either. And I told Peter about it one time, and he thought that was just the funniest thing, that I was buying candy and goodies with buttons. And I always thought I was actually buying things with those buttons. It was kind of cool. But Ernie was really nice, and the store was a great place to hang out, because it was always, you know. In the summertime, it was cool because of the way it's built, out of brick and all. But in the winter, it always had a nice fire going in the potbelly stove, and so it was always warm back here in the corner. And I could just sit in the corner and do whatever I wanted. The old guys that were around here, they always, you know, just let me sit with them. I don't remember lots about the guys that the old timers, but I know I knew them, and they knew me, and I had nicknames, They called me Annie Oakley and Plug Street Annie, because when I was first born, my parents rented a house across the street from Ernie and Blanche Poggio that belonged to the Bonos, which is another old family here in town and around the county. And they rented the house there when I was born. And so my nickname for years was Plug Street Annie. Mm-hmm. And so, actually, that takes me back down Plug Street, which, I'm trying to remember who lived in that house when I was growing up.
In the house you had been born in?
The house that I was born in. I don't remember. The house next to it, Catherine and I think it was Ted Houck lived there. Catherine Houck? Catherine Houck. And it's funny, they died when I was pretty young, but I remember them, or at least I remember her. They were really nice, and they were not from here originally. They became really good friends with my mom and dad, I think. And they were pretty well educated. But I don't remember a lot about them. But I do remember I went to their house a lot, but I don't remember lots about them. But they were really nice. And then next door to them, on the northwest corner of Plug Street and Constellation, was Rosie Gillick. And Rosie was the youngest sister of John Gillick, who still lives here in Volcano. And she was the daughter of Georgia Gillick. And she was what, at that time, would have been called Tetched. She kind of was, I don't know what happened to her, why, if she was born with a handicap, a little bit of a mental handicap, or if she was, something happened to her. Maybe somewhere along the line, maybe Terry Grillo, who is related to the Gillicks, maybe he will know what was going on with Rosie, but it didn't matter. She was just a really sweet lady, did lots of yard work for people, had chickens, had eggs and stuff, and she was, like, watched out for all the kids here in town, always, kept her eye out for them. I've heard stories that when she was a child, that she tried to go to the one-room schoolhouse at that time was going, and she wanted to go to school, and she wanted to learn and go to school, and they would send her home because they didn't have the time and the patience, and they didn't understand that they could possibly have actually taught her like they could nowadays, probably. So she was very shy and uncomfortable with adults for the most part, but she really got along well with us kids for the most part, until I think some of the kids, the older kids, teased her a lot, probably. I know I never did, and I don't think my brother ever did, but I know that, you know, how people can be like that when somebody's different. But when I was little, she would give me nickels occasionally. Give me a nickel so that I could go buy a soda. And then when I was an adult, she would, and I had my own son, and he was running around town as a little boy, she would give him quarters. He got quarters. He actually, I guess she understood about that it was, that money was, a nickel wasn't enough at that time. That was in the 70s, though. 80s, actually. But she was always cool. And then she woke up to the world kind of in the late 70s, when a lot of new and young people moved to Volcano. Young as in, you know, their 30s, actually in late 20s and stuff. They were artists and of different sorts. I don't know, Volcano kind of attracts interesting people occasionally. And this was a time when quite a few people moved to town, and they didn't know anything about Rosie, and so they just liked her friendliness, and so they became really, you know, they were always outgoing with her and encouraged her to be more part of the town than she had ever been before. And so she started, it kind of opened up her shell, and she became really much more outgoing and friendly. And she'd come down and she'd sit downtown, and she'd always say hello to everybody. And people still to this day come back and say that they remember Rosie and how friendly she was, and how she'd tell them, you know, a little bit about what she knew about the town, where things were, and things like that. And she was the town greeter, and it was really wonderful that those people, because that moved here, that didn't know her as a child and didn't think of her as, they knew she was different, of course, but they just didn't care. They were brought up in a different era when there was more acceptance, and so they did it. They just automatically accepted her, and it was wonderful because she became a active part of everybody instead of just a few people. She was always the bell ringer at the Catholic Church, and nobody could ring a bell like that, like Rosie could ring a bell. She rang it just perfectly. And she was pretty neat.
Rosie is no longer
alive. She's no longer alive. She went to, she started having some health problems, and there was nobody really to take care of her and help her out, really. And so she went down and lived the last probably 7 or 8 years. I'm not sure how long she was there. She was at Kit Carson Convalescent Hospital in Jackson, which was, at first people, we were all worried and sad that she was going there, because unfortunately convalescent hospitals are so often, you know, just a waiting room for somebody to die. But Rosie, being the type of person she was, she went down there and she loved it. She was so friendly. She made friends with everybody and the visitors that came there to visit anybody else. She just would say, she was the greeter there. And she made friends with the elderly people that were there. And she actually, I think she made a lot of the people down there, their last days, more happy, because Rosie tended to be happy. She had very good instincts about people. There were a few people she didn't like. Not many, but there were a few people that she did not care for. And it usually turned out that those people were, yeah, they weren't really the nicest people. But otherwise, she was just really, she had a huge heart, and I think she undoubtedly made a lot of those people down there have their last days a much happier place, because they never probably had enough visitors. But she was kind of there visiting all the time.
That's a beautiful story.
Yeah, Rosie was great.
Mm-hmm.
She was a
one of a kind
person, and very, very special. And it was, you know, it is amazing. People always come back here and remember Rosie. And there are pictures of Rosie here in the store now. I think that it's really wonderful that she became the person that she was able to become. And I'm very grateful to, because I was friendly with her, but I didn't do, you know, what these other people did. And the people that moved here, the artists like Brad Devereaux and his brother and Marianne, and people that opened little shops here in town and showed their artwork and things, they're the ones that really drew Rosie out. And it was their doing that brought Rosie out of her shell and just made her into this. She bloomed like a rose that she was named from.
They liked her because she was a character.
Yep, and she was a nice character.
Mm-hmm.
She was never unpleasant at all. I mean, she was just she liked being in a good mood, and that's what she tended to be.
I like the way that you said that, like the rose she became.
Yep, well, she was. She was. It was kind of an appropriate name for them, and nobody really realized it until then, I think, probably. But she did.
Bloomed to be that person.
Yeah.
I'm amazed that as we go around the block, you knew all of these neighbors by name and house, and had been in all of their homes. That's an unusual childhood.
Most of the houses in town I've been in, there's a few that I don't think I ever went into. There's a few people's houses here in town that I really don't think I ever went into. Lottie Greaseback's house, I don't think I was ever inside of Lottie's.
No, where was her house?
Her house was across the street again from my parents' house, next door to Charlie and Irene Cook's house, on the corner of Church Street, it's the northeast corner of Church and Consolation. And the house is still there, and it's owned by some totally out of county people. But Lottie, I remember, she was a very old lady when I was young. I don't remember when she died or anything, but my mother told stories about Lottie, and I knew Lottie, and Lottie was, for an old lady, was pretty wild. She always had different colored hair. She had pink hair, she had blue hair, she had purple hair, well, light, these were pastel colors, not like nowadays, but she had her hair different colors. Quite often. I mean, like every month, her hair color would be different. I assume her hair was actually white underneath, because actually I remember it being white at some point late in life. But she dyed it all these pastel, pretty colors. And from what I understand from my mother, she was quite the wild woman. And she did drink, and she entertained men. But I don't remember all the stories. My mother has some funny stories about Lottie. And Lottie was really nice. I mean, I remember Lottie was really nice. I mean, always a nice person to me. And to Mom. Mom liked her. But she was a little loose, I guess. I think she was lonely, myself. And I think my mother knew that, too. But she lived alone there, and she was, and I know I remember her, voice being loud there sometimes, but not like she was fighting with anybody. I don't think anybody was there. I don't remember a lot about Lottie, but I'm pretty sure I'd never been in that house, ever. But Lottie was really, I'm hoping that somebody else that we interview somewhere around down the road will be able to talk about Lottie. Peter Poggio might be able to, because I remember Lottie really kind of fondly, except that I don't remember much about her, except for the little wild stories that my mother told, that because she did entertain men. So it was, I think she wasn't totally accepted by everybody else in town, maybe because of that. I don't know. But I think she's from an old family, too, in town. I'm not sure of that. And then, let's see. I'm going to come back to my house and go down the street on this side, on the south side of Consolation. I was right next door at the time I was growing up at the moment I cannot remember who lived there, and yet I do know who lived there, but I can't think of who it was. But the next house down from there, on the corner, on the southeast corner of Plug and Consolation again, was Eloise and Dan Crew. And Eloise was from an old family here in town, related to the Grillos, I think. Or the DeLucchis, some of the Italian family, and eventually we'll be able to figure out who that is. But there are pictures of her family, very old pictures, in the town hall, and probably of Eloise too. And I'm not sure what Dan ever did. I don't know what he did for a living at all. I'm not sure if he was working when I knew him or not, because they were pretty elderly at the time. But I used to go play there, because I knew, like, their grandchildren, I think. And right now, I can't even think who the grandchildren were. I think that'll come up eventually, too, because I will be talking to people that will help me remember who those people were. But they had a really nice yard. It was fun to play in their yard. And they were always really nice to me, too. I mean, almost everybody in town was always, I was welcome in their house, you know, running around loose as a child. And the one thing I remember really clearly about Dan and Eloise was that at Halloween, every year, they made the very best popcorn balls I have ever had in my whole life. And I used to beg, as I got older, I used to beg them, please make me an extra one. Please, an extra one. But they never would, because it was such a huge job to make as many as they did for all the town's kids and the kids of the outlying areas that would come and go trick-or-treating here at Volcano. Because at the time, for years, pretty much everybody knew how many kids were going to come trick-or-treating. So they were able to count out what they needed. And it was just locals that would come to trick-or-treat in Volcano. So, but it was still a pretty big batch of popcorn balls they had to make, and it was a lot of hard work. But they were really good. Oh, to this day, I wish I could get their recipe. I think I'll have to ask Nancy about that. Maybe she has it. Yeah, Dan and Eloise were wonderful. And then across Plug Street, on the southwest corner of Plug and Consolation, I'm having a hard time remembering who lived there. I do remember it was two old ladies. And I knew them and I liked them, and half the time I always felt like their house was haunted and that they were witches living there. I'm never sure how I felt about that place. But they were really nice ladies, but they were really old. And they didn't come out very often. And I think we will definitely find out from somebody else who was living there when I was a little girl, because they were another part of old family. David, that house is just a beautiful little house, little Victorian type house.
Is it still there?
Yes. It's been kept up really well. And the house that was, I was on the other side of Eloise and Dan Cruz, and I couldn't remember who lived there at the time, although it's just on the edge of my mind, that's where Toby and Carol Cook rent right now. And we will be interviewing them then, and maybe they'll even be able to tell me who was living there when I was growing up. I think they will. But next door to the little house on Plug Street, the next door house down, was Goldie and Bob Porter. And they were two of my very favorite people in the whole town. Bob used to walk me around town holding my hand all the time. And he made up other nicknames for me, which I'll never understand exactly. I never did have actually ask him what it all. He actually, maybe I did ask him when I was a grown-up what it meant. I don't think he ever just really had a name or reason for my names, except that he loved me. And Bob was very old, but he lived a long time. And Goldie lived quite a long life, too. But they were, I remember them always as being old, of course.
What was the nickname?
Well, Bob called me, he called me Annie Oakley, and he called me, let me think. He had several names. He called me his Honey Buckle, which I think Honey Buckle, I think is a type of dessert. It's like, you know, those old names for puddings and things like that, and cobbler
buckle,
type things, buckle.
Buckle is a dough and custard.
Right. Okay, so I was his Honey Buckle. And Eddie Get Your Gun. That was when I was a little older. But Honey Buckle was the one that I remember really clearly. He always called me his Honey Buckle. And I would go visit him and Goldie. And Goldie was this little old lady. She always makes me think of the crone of the three
ages of women.
It seemed like she was very wise, but in a very, very old-fashioned way. Very ancient type of way. I don't think she was highly educated. But maybe she was more highly educated than I realized. But I think just because of the times that she was raised, she was, you know, it was an old-fashioned education for a girl, because girls didn't get taught the same things guys did, men did, and boys. But she was so sweet, and just boy, they loved each other. They loved each other till the day they died. When Goldie died, it broke Bob's heart. But he went on, and can you put this on pause for a moment? Are we on again?
We are continuing. We are leaving Bob.
Goldie's. We haven't left Got Bob and Goldie's yet, because I'll tell a little bit about Bob and Goldie. I only know little things, but Bob used to walk me around town holding my hand. I remember that we would walk. The thing is, when I was growing up, I was born in 1955. Everybody else in this town, my brother was born in 1952, so he's 3 years older than me. But so Chris and I and Jimmy Welch, Jim Welch was, I think, a year older than Chris, but right around the same age. And so they played together, but there was nobody else in this town that was my age. Nobody. Jeannie Gillick, who I did go to school with later, and who did live in town, but she didn't live in town. She lived outside of town and up the hill. And when she was little, that's where she was. She was up the hill. She never came down into Volcano to play or anything. So I played by myself in Volcano almost always, just by myself. So the old people in town were my playmates. That's who I played with. I mean, I'd go and play around their houses, and they would just always be friendly with me and welcome me to their house and be, you know, say I could play with whatever they had there to play with. because they might have toys from their own children when they were little or something like that, although I don't remember lots of stuff like that, but I just know that I was just kind of welcome to be come and go. I feel now as an adult, or actually as a young or old teenager, after, because I read from the age of 4 on, I was a reader like crazy, and so I'd read about Helen Keller and everything. It kind of reminds me of the Helen Keller movie, that she went around from place to place at the table and took everybody else's food, whatever smelled good. Well, that was kind of me. I was running around town kind of like from place to place, and I was okay because my mother always knew that I was okay because everybody watched out for me. But all these old people were my friends, and it was
a very privileged childhood in a way.
It was. It was excellent. I loved it. I grew up here with so much freedom, and it made me really independent, and I had a really good imagination. I did not have imaginary friends. I know that. But I had magical animals. Like, I had a magic horse that I could ride, and it flew and it talked. And I loved horses from, I don't know where I met my first horse, but boy, I loved horses from really young age. But Bob would always, you know, I'd come walking down the street and he'd be sitting on his porch and he'd say, "Hello, Honey Buckle," and he'd get up and he'd walk me down the rest of the way down the street. And we'd go downtown, and he'd be holding my hand downtown, and we'd talk, and just talk about stuff. I have no idea what we talked about, but he was a really good friend. And when later on in life, when I was an adult, and I was pregnant with my son, Bob was very adamant that my child was going to be born on his birthday. His birthday was February 19th. Oh, good Lord, what year was it? But Mac was born, my son, was due, supposedly, on the 17th of, or earlier, of February. But Bob kept saying, "Nope, that baby's going to be born on my birthday." And sure enough, he was. He was born right on Bob's birthday. And Bob just said, "I knew it." So I actually have a picture of me with Mac on my horse when Mac was just a week or so old in front of their house talking to Bob and Goldie. Somewhere. I do have that picture. It's kind of cool. And Bob, he lived quite a few years after that, after Mac was born. Mac was born in 78. And Bob died in 84 or 85. And he walked Mac around holding his hand and talking to him and stuff. And there's a really good, I have a really, really wonderful photograph of him and Mac sitting together. But Bob was just a wonderful man, and Goldie was so sweet, and she just had the most wrinkly face, like she'd been in the sun all her life, and it was a smiley, wrinkly face. It was just wonderful. I miss both of them very much. Actually, I miss most all of the people that have passed away from this town, but there were certain ones that were really, really special, and Bob and Goldie were two of them. And
who's in their house now?
Nobody.
Nobody?
Nobody. The house is falling to wreck and ruin. It just got sold, I think. There's been... Since then, it belonged to Ronnie Yeomans, or to the Yeomanses, because Ronnie was related to them in one way or another, and I'm not positive of how he was related exactly. I don't think they were his grandparents. Maybe they were his grandparents. Good Lord, I guess I'll have to engrave it and ask Ronnie. after they passed away and everything, it did get rented out a couple times. But that house was one that had just the very fundamentals of indoor plumbing. I don't even know if it had indoor plumbing back then or anything. I mean, it was a really old, you know, one of the old clapboard houses that was built in, like, I don't know if it was built in the 1800s, but it was certainly built in the early 1900s, and no more recent than that. And it's never had lots of upgrading, or any really much upgrading. Now, I do know the person, whoever it was that bought it the most recently, I think, I noticed that he had a septic system in there now. There's a septic system in that property. But I'm not sure how up to date it is or what, but the house is just so, it's been neglected for so long. I'm wondering if whoever he's selling it to or has sold it to will have the money to be able to preserve it and make it livable, or if they're just going to tear it down.
Yeah, they might have no choice.
And it will be very sad if they have to tear the whole thing down, because it's a lovely little house. I'll have to show it to you.
Okay.
Off the street. Then, we're continuing down Consolation Street at this point, which when I was a little kid, there was no other house until you got across Jerome Street on Consolation, and then there was a little old white house that is next door to the brewery where Ruth Gottstein lives, which has, in recent years, Ruth owns it, and maybe she doesn't own it anymore. Maybe she sold it to the, I don't know if she sold it or not. She did own it up until now, but I'm not sure if she's renting it out or if somebody else is. Somebody else owns it and rents it, but I think Ruth still owns it. But it had historic value in the sense that the general Liversedge was born and raised there. And he is the officer, the Marine Corps officer, who at the time was not a general. I forget what type of officer he was, what rank he had. I think it was a major maybe or something. I'm not positive. I have to go back into history. But he was the ranking officer who led his battalion to raise the flag on Mount Suribachi on the island of Iwo Jima during World War II. And so he was born and raised in that little house. But when I was a little girl, somebody else lived there, who was kind of infamous here in town. His name was Ken Jonas. He was Arnold Jonas's uncle. And Ken had originally worked for PG&E also, and I'm hoping that somebody else will, in the histories, in fact, maybe Del Simpson or someone else will be able to tell us more about Ken, because Ken was a very, very nice man. And as a little girl, he was just the nicest man to me. But he was also an embarrassment to his family, and all because he was known as the town drunk.
Mm-hmm.
And he really was the town drunk. There's funny stories I can tell about Ken, and I probably will tell them because they were funny. But of course, anybody that's a nice person that just falls into becoming an alcoholic, it's very sad. And my mother really liked Ken, and Ken didn't take care of himself very much, and his family didn't. Arnold and Gert just, you know, kind of acted like he didn't exist most of the time. And my mother having the Jug and Rose little restaurant, she made the soup, but she always made sure that Ken had a meal, a hot meal, and was taken care of. And I remember, though, as a little kid, it was hard. Even though I liked Ken, it was so hard to be around him because he smelled so awful. Because he drank so much, and he was a true alcoholic in the sense that he was an old man that didn't take care of himself, that didn't bathe often enough. The house that he lived in had no upgrading at all. I'm not sure it even had a sink inside of it with water, running water. I think it must have had sink with running water, but he had a real outhouse still outside the place. So I don't know how he bathed, really. But his outhouse has some funny stories about it, too. We have some good stories about his outhouse. Poor Ken. Adam Gottstein, Ruth Gottstein's son, youngest son, and I were very good friends. And we were, as little kids, they would come up on weekends and we would play together. And one year he came up with meat and milk for me. Thank you very much, Debbie. And one weekend, that was probably early in the year, because I think it was either early in the year or late in the year, and I'm not sure which, but he had gotten a bow and arrow set for a gift. And he brought this bow and arrow set up to Volcano. And we were playing with it out in the backyard of the brewery, shooting arrows up into the air and stuff. And one came, Adam was, we weren't very old, we were probably like 8 or 9 years old, but he was able to shoot this one way up in the air, and it went way up high, and it came down hard enough and fast enough that it came down and landed and poked right through the roof of Ken's outhouse. And we soon found out, because there was a great yell, that Ken was in the outhouse at the time. And he came, the door flew open, and he came stumbling out of the outhouse with his pants half down, screaming, "Engines! Engines!" And Adam and I we needed the outhouse after that. We were in hysterics, but it was horrible. When we think about it later, we both felt terrible, but we also thought it was just hysterically funny.
It is both the things at the same time.
At the same time, but it was horrible, because, I mean, obviously he was drunk enough to the reality of, you know, Indians. I mean, certainly we didn't have wild Indians in the area, but an arrow coming through the ceiling of his outhouse while he's sitting there in a stupor from his last drink was enough to send him a little out of his mind, and it was horrible. But it was also extremely funny. And
did he find it funny later?
I don't think we ever talked to him about it.
Oh, okay.
I think we were scared to talk to him about it. Thank you very much. Can we pause it for a minute?
Yes, we'll pause it.
Thank you. Because I
it's in there, Rebecca.
Oh, okay.
Okay,
Okay. Well, Ken was such a nice man, but he was drunk a very good deal of the time. And he had a wonderful black lab dog that named Blackie, of course. And that was a running joke with our local kids. Because he'd go out the night to call Blackie, and we could all copy Ken calling Blackie. And we'd all go around going, "Blackie! Blackie!"
Kids are awful that way.
We're awful that way. Well, although there weren't too many mean things done to him, but then Adam and I did that with an arrow, but that we didn't mean to do, but we did do something that we were very ashamed of later, because we actually built a bear trap for him, a tiger trap. We dug a hole and we thought we'd trap him, but we didn't, thank God. He actually trapped himself a number of times going through the fence line to go to, from the bar to his house. He had a path that would go from the bar to the over here at the St. George and cut across the field. It was a vacant lot where the new post office is, to his house. And there was an old fence, old barbed wire fence that was down, totally down on the ground, but there was one gap in the fence where there was actually a path through it, so there was no fencing. Well, that was his path from the back of his house to the bar. And he would, that was his path. And he didn't even have to be sober to be able to find his way to and from. And my mom and dad told me a story one time about Ken, a real bad night for Ken, because he'd been at the bar, at the saloon, drinking, and he came home, he walked home, and he missed the path. And he tripped over the fence instead. And he, what everybody figured out must have happened was he tripped over the fence and it flipped him over so that when he got up, he was facing back to the saloon. So he just walked back to the saloon instead. Went back in and either had another drink or just went back in and then turned around and came, headed back home again. And I guess it must have, he must have missed the path 3, 4, or 5 times, because by the time, every time he went back in, this was a story told to my parents by, I think, the bartender, who was probably Walt Blomquist, and that he'd come back in and he was all banged up and he was all covered in dirt and weeds, and every time he came back, it was worse. And finally, somebody walked him back home. But what he kept doing was he kept tripping over the fence and turning around and going back to the saloon. And it was just, it was kind of a very funny story now, but really sad too. Mm-hmm. And my mom and dad thought it was funny, but also very sad, because they really liked Ken, because he was a good man. And I remember many times taking bowls of soup over to his house and knocking on his back door and so grateful, and he was just the nicest guy. And then Adam and I built the tiger trap for him because of that path from the saloon to his house. We decided it would be really funny, except for I don't think we, in fact I know, he and I really didn't want to trap him, but we just thought it would be funny to build a trap. If he had fallen in it, I think Adam and I would have just been, it would have broken our hearts. But it was fun digging the hole. Digging the hole and putting grass over the top of it and stuff. So it was a blind, you know, it was like a tiger trap, it was a Ken trap. But he never did fall in it, thank heavens. I'll never forget doing that, that was awful. One of the mean things I've done in my life. Except that,
and you get to remember them forever.
Yes, although at least though I get to remember them, that he never fell in it,
right.
Because it would have been horrible.
He might have broken his
Oh
leg.
Yeah, it would have been awful. It would have been terrible, but it was fun building it. And Ken, yeah, he was, and he told, and I know that he told Mom and Dad stories of his work up on the PG&E lines, up country, and stuff like that. But I don't know any of them, I don't think. But he'd come into the jug, and he'd sit and have coffee and soup or sandwich. And my mother was always made sure that he had food. If it was cold, she would go over to make sure he was all right. And one day, he hadn't been in for a couple of days, and my Uncle Bill went over there, and he wasn't all right anymore, and he was gone, and my Uncle Bill found him. Sad that he died all alone.
I can't.
It was sad that he died all alone, But I'm glad that he was kind of part of our family a little bit. And then the brewery is next door, and that nobody lived in really until the Gottsteins, of course, came up on weekends. They owned it for quite a long time before they actually were coming up and staying at it. Well, maybe they started staying at it soon after, but they had been coming up here for so many years camping at all. And that's how I first met them, was when they were still camping and things. And then they bought the brewery. And so then they came up quite often. And Adam was my first boyfriend of my own age. He was my city boyfriend. All my other boyfriends were the milkman, the ice cream man that would deliver, and they all would bring me treats. And back then, it was all innocent. But and across the street from the brewery is the Union Inn, which has always been the Union Hotel. It was a boarding house back in the 1800s, I think. And it sort of, when I was a kid, I remembered several people living in that place. But when I was really little, I was seven. Because I remember that was seven, because that was the age I was when, so that was 1962, when the Whites, the family of the Whites, owned the Union, and they had a big family. It was Ruth White was the mother. Ruth and I can't remember the father's name. I do know it. And then they had a boy named Roland and a boy named Nick, but we all called him Kook. And he still goes by the name Kook, as far as I know. And then an older daughter named Lanny. Oh, maybe Kook's name wasn't Nick, because Lanny was the oldest girl. Nikki was the next girl down. Then Wendy and Penny. And Penny was a year older than me. So she was 8 when I was 7. And when I was 7, I mean, they lived there for probably when I was 5, 6, 7, 8, maybe for probably 4 years or so.
They lived on the top floor.
They lived upstairs, and they actually opened the place up. They cooked on weekends, I think it was, and opened up like a family style dinner in there. They didn't have it open to people staying there, but people could come in to eat. Because I remember peeling spuds, lots of spuds, huge bags of burlap bags of spuds. Penny's dad would stick coins into the spuds, into the potatoes. He would stick them in sideways, and then every once in a while somebody would find one when they were peeling the potatoes. You'd find one as you were peeling, and you'd get to keep the coin, of course. But Kook, when I was 7 years old, Kook swiped. He was a lot older. He was probably 12, something like that. And he swiped his mother's Lucky Strike cigarettes. And we went up into the manger scene up above the pool on Indian Hill. And I had my first puff of a cigarette, which made me sick and cough a lot, and so that was the last one I had until I was a teenager. Thank heavens. But I remember that. But we played there all the time. Me and Penny and I were really good friends. Wendy was a little bit older, so she was our friend, and we played with her too, but not as much because she was older. But playing at the Union Inn was so much fun, and at Halloween, on a number of occasions they had a basement in the place that was later on in the winter, if it was too wet, if we'd had too much rain late in the year, in the year before Halloween, we couldn't do this because it would flood. The basement of the any basements around Volcano really, but the Union and the brewery were I knew about and I'd been into in the winter when it had 6 feet of water in it. But I always thought if it wasn't winter you could swim in it. But it wasn't. It was cold. But otherwise they made the best haunted house down in their basement. It was scary. Oh my gosh. They did creepy things down in there. And it wasn't very big, but it was really creepy. And it was fun. It was scary but it was great. And there's a little girl who is a ghost in the Union Inn that played with us when we were kids upstairs. And I remember her, and it's very strange. I've been thinking about it a lot because I've told the story about having known her when I was little to quite a few people in the last year, and I keep thinking to myself, I have never talked to Penny or Wendy or Nikki about that little girl ever that I know of. So I wonder if I think they saw her, but I wonder if they remember or if they have any memories of it like I do, because I have real vivid memories of her being there. I know she never talked to us. I don't remember anything she ever said, if she ever said anything. I just remember her presence there with us. So I have no idea really in my memory if they saw her too or if I was the only one that saw her. I should ask them. I will. One of these days I will ask them.
The answer will be interesting, I think.
I am very curious to know.
The older a child gets, the less capable that they are of experiencing those.
That's true. Well, Penny was only a year older than me, so she may have seen her, but maybe Wendy didn't, but I don't know. Because we were playing dolls and stuff. I mean, just stuff, hide and seek up there and stuff like that. Card games, things like that. And she didn't. I don't remember there was no real interaction that I can recall, although I'm not sure of that because my memory is very fuzzy, but I remember her being there. I remember what she looked like. For the most part, although I sometimes almost superimpose her what was her name? The little girl who played Laura Ingalls in the Little House on the Prairie. But the little girl kind of looked like her, except she was blonder than Laura Ingalls. Who played Laura Ingalls? I can't remember her name.
When you say it, I would.
I don't. Wonderful little actress, young woman. Because the clothing that the little girl wore was very similar to what Laura Ingalls always wore, you know, little pinafore dresses and her hair in pigtails and stuff. And I just remember that. But she was blonder and she was real little. She was probably around the age that I was, maybe six, seven, 8 years old. When she must have passed away. And I do not have any idea who she was. And my mother never heard any stories of who she was.
Had other people seen her?
Other little children have seen her since then. I don't know any adults that have seen her. But a few years ago, Lori and Matt... He writes for the Ledger Dispatch, and she works down at Lake Amador. They have since divorced, but they had twin little girls, Chloe and what was her other little girl's name? I always forget their names. It was Chloe and somebody else. I want to say Zoe, but I don't know if that was correct. They were 3 years old, three, four. I think they moved out of there before they turned five. But those little girls used to play upstairs, and they played with the little girl too. They told Lori and Matt about the little girls, and when they'd come back downstairs to have dinner or something, they'd wave to her, and Lori says that she, because they lived there for a while, she says that she thinks she felt a tugging on her apron strings type of thing on the back of her skirt or clothes, mm-hmm. you know, periodically and stuff, but she never saw her though, mm-hmm. but she felt her there being there. Mm-hmm. So I think the little girl is like, if you're there for a long period of time and she gets comfortable with you, with children, she will let children see her and let other people feel her mm-hmm. presence. I think, like you said, as you get older, you're not as open to seeing things like that, maybe necessarily. But Lori was kind of accepting of it. She accepted the fact that the kids it wasn't just an imaginary friend necessarily. And then when she told me about it, I said, oh my gosh, that's the same little girl that I used to play with. And so she knew that there was something there, so she just accepted that it was. And the little girl was never anything scary at all. So supposedly she's been seen by a few other kids over the years, I think, but I don't know. That place was, I don't remember who the Whites sold that, the Union to next, but I think it might have been this old guy that I swear, I truly believed he was Buffalo Bill for a long time. I wasn't sure, because he called himself Buffalo Bill, I think, or something like that, or William Cody, or something. I'm not sure if he really was or wasn't, but he had a lot of stuff that was very interesting stuff. It was kind of a museum kind of stuff, Western Museum he had in there, all kinds of weird things.
When would that have been? 60s?
60s. Late 60s. I wonder if he had that. Well, that's all of consolation.
Mm-hmm. And on the corner, on the very corner where your parents had first had the apartment, what people have been there, who owns that now, and what's been there since?
You mean where the trading post site is?
Yes. It was the one on the corner where you told me that they had, when they first came, they had an apartment there.
After I was born at all, and they had rented the house for, I guess, a couple of years, they then moved into the apartment up above there, and it belonged at that time to Walt Blomquist.
And that's the one, this kitty corner to the jugging.
Yes, it's right on the corner of Consolation and Charleston Volcano Road. It's part, the building is connected to the Masonic Hall, the Odd Fellows of Masonic Hall. And living up there was just a really small apartment. It was kind of strange. I mean, here were two children and two adults, and basically it was only two rooms. It had a bedroom, a bathroom, a living room, and a kitchen. So Mom and Dad slept in the living room area, and Chris and I shared the bedroom. We had a bunk bed, if I recall. A bunk bed, yes, we did. And then there was a staircase that went down into the gift shop or out the side door. And my parents had a gift shop down in there. And it was really a neat gift shop. It had all kinds of stuff in it. In fact, one of our display cases is still in that building that belongs to me. So I should probably figure, I'm pretty sure I know which one it was. But I should talk to the people that own the place. And I do know the guy who owns it now, I know his mother. So I should talk to her soon before maybe I could sell it.
Or maybe Jackie could use it.
Maybe. That's a possibility.
She said she needs
a display case, but it's a, well, it's not a cool display case, but it is a nice display case. Mm-hmm. It's bigger than the one that's in there, okay. The jug. But they sold historical stuff, books, and postcards, and rock collections, and all kinds of stuff. I vaguely remember. And then they had lots of stuff on display that was just kind of oddball stuff that I still have some of. And my dad was gone a lot. He worked at the CYA camp, but he also was in the Navy Reserve, so he was gone at least once a month doing saving the country, as we used to put it. And also because he was a teacher and parole officer of CYA and stuff, so he traveled to a couple other CYA camps periodically, and also had to go and visit with his parolees check on them periodically. So he was in Stockton and Sacramento and stuff like that. But Mom was here running the Jug and Rose, and my Uncle Bill was here helping to run the Jug and Rose and going off camping and going painting.
Where did your Uncle Bill live?
He lived in the cottage behind the Jug and Rose. They built that. After they built the jug, they built the cottage so Bill would have a house.
Mm-hmm.
He came from Piedmont, California, down the Bay Area, Alameda, California.
Sure.
Alameda. He was born in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And he came to the United States, I think when he was 19. And his father remarried. I don't know what happened to his actual mother.
And he did not marry.
Bill never did marry anyone. Nope. We need to stop for a minute because I need to blow my nose.